On this episode of the London Lyceum, we talk with Dr. Alexander Hampton and Dr. John Peter Kenny about Christian Platonism. So we cover topics like, what is Platonism? What is Christian Platonism? How much of an impact did Platonism have on Christianity? And what areas of Christian theology are most shaped by Platonism and which are most antithetical to it, if there are any at all? Those sorts of questions are all throughout this episode. As always, if you have thoughts about the episode or ideas for the show in general, you can hit us up, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Check us out at our website, thelondonlyceum.com, or chat more about it with us in the London Lyceum Society. Now, for the only analytic, Baptist, and confessional podcast on the planet, what do you think this one's going to get you thinking? I'd like to welcome all of our listeners to another episode of the London Lyceum. I'm one of your hosts, Jordan Stefaniak.
And I'm your co-host, Brandon Askew.
And we here at the London Lyceum are a podcast that is dedicated to serious thinking because we think the church needs more serious thinking. But we do it in a way that we hope to create an intellectual culture or an intellectual climate of charity, curiosity, critical thinking, and cheerful confessionalism. And today I am so excited to introduce you all to two new friends who have published this really, really interesting work on titled Christian Platonism, a History. It's edited by Alexander Hampton, who we have, and John Peter Kenny, who we have as well. And this book, I think, is really fascinating. It's got a lot of, you've got pretty much all sorts of high-powered scholars in here. So I've been reading it myself. I'm almost done, and I've really benefited from it. And I think there's a lot of really unique, interesting contributions in it. So I'm looking forward to just talking a little bit about the overall scope and why you guys got interested in this and things along those lines. So before we do that, though, why don't I have both of you introduce yourselves a little bit for the listeners who may not be familiar with you. So Dr. Hampton, I'll let you start, and then Dr. Kenny can go after that. But just give me a little bit of background, and then why is it that you got interested in Christian Platonism of all things?
Well, thanks, first off, Jordan and Brandon, for having us. We really appreciate the interest in the book. My name is Alex Hampton. I'm a professor at the University of Toronto in the Department for the Study of Religion. And I specialize in really three areas: poetics, ecology, and philosophy, all in the Christian tradition. And of course, what connects each one of those is this kind of engagement I have with a metaphysical tradition of Christian Platonism. I see it as providing a way to conceptualize how we understand nature, how we understand aesthetics, and how we use philosophy to both understand the history of Christianity and understand the way Christianity has expressed itself throughout its history.
Well, hi, everybody. Thanks so much for having us on today. I got into this business of Christian Platonism because I originally started out in the study of Greek philosophy. So I'm going back quite a ways here, back to the 70s. And I also was very interested in philosophy of religion and in metaphysics. I started out studying ancient philosophy, and I became exceptionally intrigued by the emergence of two things: philosophical monotheism in late antiquity, and also, of course, specifically the development of Jewish and Christian philosophy emerging out of the Greco-Roman philosophical tradition. What's new, what's different, and so on. And in some respects, I have to admit, I was frustrated by, in many ways, the thinness of some of the philosophy of religion that I was reading in that period, and also impressed by the extraordinary depth of those great founders of the Jewish and Christian philosophical tradition when I read them. And so I got absolutely absorbed in trying to understand Philo, Justin, Clement, Origen, Augustine, and on the other side, of course, Plato, Aristotle, Plotinus, and trying to understand that whole incredibly rich milieu out of which what we think of as Western monotheism emerged. I've also been interested in the continuing trajectory, of course, of this, and especially interested in comparative Jewish, Christian, and Islamic monotheism. So that's kind of how I got into this. And I did my doctorate at Brown in religious studies, where they were doing a lot of this comparative work. And I taught out on the West Coast for many years, Reed College. Then I taught at St. Michael's College, where I was also dean up in Vermont, and now I'm retired. So I'm speaking to you from the rocky coast of Maine, Cape Elizabeth.
All right. Well, thank you both for giving us some of your time today. If you don't mind, I guess we'll start with just something very basic, a definition of Platonism. So we have a wide range, I think, of folks who listen to our show. Some folks are pastors, some are PhDs, some just are lay people in the church. So a lot of this is going to be redundant for some folks, but for those who don't know, maybe just give us either one of you guys a definition of Platonism.
Well, I'd say something. I think what the first thing I'd say is the distinction between the philosophy of Plato and Platonism. So we can think about the character of Socrates, who expresses Plato's philosophy. We can think about the writings of Plato, but then of course there's the 2,000 year plus history that follows out of that. And so what is it that holds all of that trajectory or that tradition together? And in many ways, I think it's what is key to it, whether you're talking about Samuel Taylor Coleridge or whether you're talking about Aquinas or Augustine or Philo or Plotinus. I think one of the key themes is this question of how does one conceptualize the relationship between God and creation, or between the finite and the infinite, between the universal and a particular, the eternal and the temporal. And I think that the project of understanding the relationship between immanence and transcendence is probably one of the key elements that holds that tradition together. And I think that's when we talk about Platonism, in many ways, we're talking about what we might also call philosophical realism, which is the belief that, or the position that our ideals are real, that they're extramental, and that they're intelligible, so that they exist outside of ourselves, and they exist in an intelligible that is a non-physical realm. And once we get into the Jewish and Christian tradition, that's something that exists in the mind of God as divine ideas. If we go back to Plato, that's something that exists in the beyond being, which are the eternal forms that God looks to through the demiurge to create. So it's best to think of it as a kind of almost a philosophical orientation in a way, as opposed to a kind of essentialist tradition, which needs to hold these, three or five tenets or something like that. John, did you want to speak to that as well?
Oh, sure. No, I think that's an excellent point that you just made here. And as we think about Platonism, I think it's a mistake to think about it too much in contemporary terms, because when we go back to ancient Platonism, it was a philosophy in the ancient sense of the term. That is, it was much broader than what we think of as philosophy today, right? It was not just a problem-solving conceptual form of discourse. It was a totalizing approach to life. Think of Socrates, right? So Platonists are trying to imitate Socrates, and they're trying to live a very austere way of life, which is consistent in general with their understanding that there is a transcendental level of reality to which the inner self in one form or another is drawn or connected. And so as we look back, we can see that the ancient Platonists were developing both a set of flexible concepts, and at the same time, working with an ethic all designed to seek out and find wisdom, right? That was the whole point of it. And they stood apart from the society around them as this began, which is one of the reasons, of course, why Christians were described so often as philosophers in antiquity. I mean, you can see that almost in Acts 17 or so, when Paul shows up at the Areopagus, right? And they look at him and they think, "Oh, guy looks like a philosopher. You know what? Let's give him a hearing," right? And Acts says, "Well, you know, they were Stoics and Epicureans, and there are all these philosophers sitting around, and they want to hear from Christians." So one of the interesting things is that from the very beginning, in that sense, Christians were philosophers, right? So Platonists had their own particular understanding. And that's, I think, one of the things that we want to try to get at here today, because their thinking was quite revolutionary, and that's what drew the Christians towards them. And it all has to do with what Alex just articulated, that notion of some type of transcendental level of reality, which was in some way also imminent, right? And that's what's drawn so many thinkers over and over again to this tradition across the board, right? Jewish, Christian, Islamic thinkers, but we can stay in our own lane here with the Christian tradition today.
Yeah, so as I'm thinking about defining Platonism, the very first chapter on the perennial value of Platonism is by Lloyd Gerson. And I know, right, I've read some other stuff from him where the way he defines Platonism seems to capture quite a big net. So I think he's argued that what Aristotle counts as a Platonist, yes, et cetera. Is right, that a fair way to define Platonism? Is that along the lines of how you would think about it? Or would you want to massage that and nuance that a little bit?
What do you think, Alex?
Well, I think if we go back to defining Platonism as something which is a form of philosophical realism that is a transcendent realism, then, you know, I think absolutely Aristotle and the Aristotelian tradition fits in that. And, you know, with going back to what John was saying, I mean, we have a very narrow definition of what we call philosophy today, but, you know, philosophy in antiquity is, you know, as has been said, a kind of way of life. It's a psychology. It's a spirituality. It's even a poetics for understanding the self and the self's relationship to creation. And as soon as we begin to talk about the kind of metaphysical component of this, which is this realist component, we see immediately that this saturation of all of immanent reality with transcendence has immediately a kind of ethical component too, because it calls forth an ethical response from the individual in terms of what their relationship with the outside world is. And so, you know, it is quite broad, and we might say, well, are we making the term so big that it becomes perhaps not so useful in the end? but I would say that what we really tried to do with this text is really track a broad trajectory of thought, and that thought, as we've said, focuses around this this issue of understanding all of immanent reality as something which has a kind of transcendent undergirding or transcendent reality underneath it. And I think that's really what is at the core of that term when we throw around Platonism. And in some ways, I in my own writing tend to use the term ontological realism more than I use Platonism, because Plato or Platonism calls to forth, you know, calls to one's mind the image of Plato and the dialogues, and I think we want to talk about something which is much broader. And so you know, the irony of the term Christian Platonism is you've got two almost undefinably broad concepts in some ways, but hopefully we'll get to the core of that today in our discussion.
Well, if I could pick up for a moment on that. I think it's very fair to have a pretty broad understanding of Platonism if we want to really capture why the Christians are interested in it in antiquity. As I've just articulated, You know, if you're in the time of Origen or Augustine later on, there are pagan Platonists around, and that, you know, they're their own school. They're not Christians, right? So in that sense, you know, none of these people would have described themselves as Christian Platonists. But the brunt of Platonism and the power of Platonism is such that it really transformed the spiritual imagination of antiquity. And this is a critical moment in the development of Western thought as we shift this great peripety over to monotheism, right, over these centuries. And Platonism and the associated Aristotelian tradition are absolutely central to that shift, because they are driving the idea that Alex has already been articulating of a particular deep understanding of transcendence. They are articulating that there is another level of reality beyond the material and the physical, which was systemic in the ancient world. Right? That's how everyone thought about the divine. That's the way the gods were. They came and went in space. You can access them in time. That changes fundamentally as we come into the Christian era. And one of the huge drivers of that is this Platonic tradition, in the generalized sense of it, as it sort of seeps into the general thinking of the ancient world, and in particular is accessed then by the leading intellectuals in the Jewish and Christian tradition. So as we think about it, what the Platonists are saying is there's a level of reality outside of space and time, that it is a higher level of reality, that this world is dependent for its existence on that world, participating in it. We're ontological clients of that higher level of reality. And that higher level of reality cannot be known in the way that we know physical or material levels of reality, but only through some kind of deeper element within the soul, which is our intellect or our nous or whatever you want to describe it as. So if you think about that, that puts a whole other layer onto your understanding of reality. You've built out a whole new ontology, which then fundamentally changed the way, at least the mainstream of philosophical reflection, began to think about God. So one of the drivers of monotheism is this idea that there is a deeper level of reality. And the way the Greeks got to their monotheism, as opposed to the Hebraic tradition with its focus on exclusivity, is this idea of a deeper, ultimate, inclusive power, the one, the good, so deep that it's beyond the intelligibles, at a higher level even than the forms or whatever one wants to describe the intelligibles as. So the good, out of which everything comes, is an extraordinarily deep power. And when we get to Plotinus, it's an infinite power. So it's an infinite force that is now, because of its very separation from space and time, absolutely immanent, ontologically, within all reality. Now that's an unbelievably powerful idea that just took hold in antiquity. And you can see it, the Platonists beginning around 90 BC really begin what we call Middle Platonism, really begin to work on this type of thinking. And by the time we get a little bit further down range into the second century, and especially when we get to Plotinus, all of these ideas have gelled. So that pagan trajectory of thinking, that Platonic trajectory of thinking, becomes the most powerful, most prestigious, most persuasive way to think about the divine. And that clicks clearly with major thinkers like Philo and Origen. And of course, and this is something else we have to think about, that whole sort of greatest generation or so of Nicenes, right, who in the fourth century are absolutely all buying into what I've just articulated, right? And this is what they bring to the table as they read the scriptures. And if you think about Ambrose, Augustine, right? And then the Cappadocians, right? All of those people, Athanasius, they're all using this way of thinking. And this is how we end up talking about mia usia tres supostases, you know, the homoousion, all of those Nicene concepts are coming out of this mode of reflection. And this is how they began to be able to grab hold of the earlier scriptural record and, as it were, jump Christianity up in its sophistication to be able to stand and articulate itself in a context where high-level philosophical thinkers on the pagan side had already assimilated the type of thinking that I've been talking about.
So what areas then, when it comes to, say, this group of Christian Platonists or Christian Platonism as a term, what areas of Christian theology are most being shaped by Platonism? Is it the stuff that you just mentioned, or is it also shaping other aspects of it? And is it more Platonist than it is Christian, or is it more Christian than it is Platonist?
I think one of the places to begin with that would probably be the divine ideas tradition. One of the places that I think is kind of very exciting, and I love showing undergraduates this sort of moment in history, is when Philo, in his interpretation of Genesis, turns to the divine ideas. What we essentially have there is Philo interprets the creation story by employing ideas from Plato's Timaeus. And the Timaeus, of course, it's the demiurge that creates looks to the ideal forms to shape a pre-existent matter. What happens, of course, in Philo is that the ideas, the forms, are moved, of course, and relocated in the mind of God, such that creation comes to be the unfolding of the divine mind. So when you look at creation, you see manifestation of the divine mind. And that sort of is an exciting moment of coming together. And you can see how, in this way, creation becomes a kind of participatory place. The term adopted out of Plato is metexis. So all of reality participates in the divine mind. What makes something what it is its participation in a divine idea. And that leads to a kind of a sacramental view of reality and understanding of nature as an unfolding of not only a divine plan, but of the divine mind, of divine ideas. And really leads to the tradition of natural theology. And at the same time, the immediate historical context, of course, is that for Christianity, which picks up deeply upon Philo's thought, is in the second century, we have a very highly Hellenized Jewish population. And so to the extent that they're interpreting their own scriptures through Greek philosophy, and this is the same world that early Christianity itself is developing in. So it, in many ways, the Hellenistic air that they're all breathing is the way that both second century Judaism is rearticulating itself, but also the way that Christianity comes to articulate itself as it forms and constitutes itself in this early period. And it's kind of a really exciting moment in history. And then you see, of course, this notion of the divine ideas picked up in Origen and then in Augustine's interpretation of Genesis. And you can see it carry through. And so this idea of looking upon creation and seeing the divine mind, I think, becomes a very key component, and also the kind of sacramental understanding of creation itself that results from it. And enfolded into that, of course, is an idea of divine mimesis as well. John, you probably wanted to speak further to that as well.
Sure. Let me pick up on that for a moment or two. One of the things that I think we have to do for a moment is sort of put ourselves into that pagan Platonic world and think about salvation. How do you achieve salvation? You now know that you're in a world that has a higher level of reality, much greater and more beautiful than the level you're in. And your soul aspires somehow to deepen that participation that Alex has just been talking about in that higher level of reality. How do you do that? Well, philosophy seems to have been, at least for a very long time, the actual practice of it, as I've described it earlier, that way towards salvation. Question is, however, is it really the case that your soul has that power within it, latent within it, to be able to connect up to those other levels? Now, within Platonism, there's a longstanding element which emphasizes reincarnation, right? That maybe your soul can't make it this time around, but maybe next time. And of course, Platonists debated extensively about what portion of the soul went on, how did the elements within the soul perdure into some other level of existence? Do you get to go and visit the forms before coming back down? Are you immediately sent off into another body? You know, how does all of that work? And of course, for some of the Platonists, even the question of whether you can come back as an animal or, you know, a bug or something like that. I admit, as an academic dean, as having gotten through quite a few faculty meetings speculating on that question in relationship to some of my colleagues. But I digress. So think about this now. Christians come along with, and they begin to absorb this transcendental understanding, right? And that longing for the good. And of course, they have the Philonic Logos theology that has come in, right? At the very beginning of the tradition, you and I prologue. And they begin to reflect on this. Now, you can see this exceptionally clearly, and I imagine most of our listeners today have read the Confessions. You can see very clearly Augustine articulating the Christian argument that, yes, the Platonists are so right on transcendence. That whole package of transcendental monotheism, yes, they have that right, Book 7, right? But what they're wrong on is their belief that their souls can be saved through philosophy. Porphyry, the student of Plotinus, says that. He says, the philosopher is his own savior. And Plotinus, over and over again, says, just pull yourself up, pull yourself together. You can do it. You have the power within you. Augustine and the Christians very clearly agree with that transcendental understanding, but disagree on the way to salvation. You need the power of divine assistance immediately through Christ. That's the articulation that is made over and over and over again by the Nicenes, right? So in that sense, I always think of them more as, and I, as Alex mentioned earlier with different terminology, I see these early Christians as sort of Christian transcendentalists. They've absorbed the larger understanding of reality coming from Platonism, but they're rejecting some very fundamental components of it, especially the soteriology. Now, I have to add a caveat. By the time we get to very late antiquity, the pagans, as you know, pagan Platonists begin to kind of build a rival religion to Christianity, and these are followers coming out of Plotinus down through Iamblichus, like Julian the apostate emperor, and they're into a new form of pagan kind of sacramental magic called theurgy, and they agreed at late in antiquity that maybe you need to access some kind of quasi-sacramental tradition, theurgical tradition, in order that souls can be lifted by the power of the gods to whom they're related. So in that sense, they're kind of, in a sense, shifting some elements from the pure philosophical mode of salvation to something that begins to resemble the Christians, which is in a kind of mute witness to the power of the Christian claim that human beings do not have that power within themselves. Right. That's the argument in the central books of the Confessions. It's a really fascinating one in that respect. I want to come back around later, but you may have some other questions. So the role of scripture in all this, but we'll, you know, you may have some other things you want to talk about.
If you'd like to go there now, we can go there now, because my question was going to be about the how Muslims and Jews, their reception of Platonism was different from the Christians. So that's probably going to relate since we're getting into scripture now. I would love for you to go there. That would be great.
Yeah, I'll do this briefly, because I know Alex may have some other things he wants to add on this. But this is the other fascinating piece of this. As we know, Origen is one of the great scriptural scholars of antiquity. And, you know, certainly Augustine was no slouch in that regard. It's almost entirely his corpus after he is ordained. It becomes scriptural commentary and works related in one way or the other, like even like De Trinitate, to scripture. One of the things we have to grasp then is that the Christians believed that this new transcendental understanding of reality was meant to be the hermeneutical key to the reading of scripture. And it opened it, as Augustine says over and over again, to layer upon layer of interpretation. It's so extraordinarily rich if we can move beyond the literal, the physical, and the material representations, which were necessary at an earlier age. But now we can see that there's so much more in the scriptures. So the reading of the scriptures becomes a central component of that sacramental understanding, right? Because the power that spoke through in earlier times is also the power, the transcendental power, that has come down in the incarnation, right? Opening very clearly that aperture for salvation to a higher world. And it's the scriptures that allow us to get hold of that and then deepen our understanding of the divine. So all of these great Christian Platonists then are interested in changing the type of life that I articulated earlier, the philosophical life, and making not just dialectic and discussion, which most certainly the Nicene spent plenty of time doing and arguing, you know, about components, this, that, and the other thing, but the actual reading, contemplative reading of scripture to draw the soul through the grace available there to that higher communion that is available through the incarnation. So that's something that we also have to really grab hold of, because that's what drives the whole Christian monastic tradition all the way down, right, to the Reformation, right? That was what they were doing, what Augustine was doing, what those early teachers were doing. And as we know, that became a very, very popular lay spirituality, right? The books of the hours, the reading of the hours, the meditation on scripture, the Lectio Divina, all of that is part of this inner meditative course towards finding the divine that is open to us through the incarnation.
You have any thoughts, Dr. Hampton?
I think just to take the story further, I think that you know, we've spoken a lot about the early church and a little bit about the medieval period, but also, you know, as someone who's a specialist more in the modern period, the tradition of Christian Platonism and the power of that sense of the transcendent is something that's turned to a number of times in the modern period to kind of reinvent or reinvigorate Christianity. So, and to kind of reconnect as well to both creation and also to the greater tradition. So I'm thinking in the early modern period, the sense of an increasing separation from the world around oneself is expressed by someone like the English pastor Thomas Traherne. He's a metaphysical poet, and what's interesting is he's just about contemporary with Francis Bacon, and they both are concerned with recovering a kind of they're both concerned with soteriology. They're both concerned with how we overcome the penalty of Adam. And for Bacon, of course, this is something he expresses in Utopia, the possibility of that's increasingly opened up through through science of reshaping creation to recreate Eden in sort of in a physical form. But then we turn to Terhune, who's drawing on the Platonic tradition. And what Terhune increasingly sees at this point in time is a kind of disconnect from the kind of natural revelation of the divine, and a kind of increasing imposition, a sort of subject-centered imposition of human desire and creation, upon creation to sort of turn it into something which has which expresses a kind of selfish end. And he talks a lot about property and enclosure and a lot of the changes that were happening economically at that point in time. And for Terhune, it was about recovering a kind of sense, a kind of almost a sensus divinitas, divinitatis in a way, of seeing the divine in creation. So he talks about, in a way that's in some ways curiously reminiscent of Emerson, of seeing beyond the kind of increasing division of the landscape that surrounds him as a countryside pastor, as agriculture is increasingly mechanized, seeing beyond these divisions to kind of a commonwealth. And for him, recovering these eyes of felicity, this kind of internal psychological, in the original sense of that, as a kind of care for the soul, for him, that's the way back to Eden. That's the way of overcoming the kind of penalty of Adam. It's something that happens for him through both worship and contemplation, but also it results in a kind of epistemological shift. Whereas he would see someone like Bacon kind of deepening the penalty of sin, and so I think that kind of capacity of Christian Platonism at different points in time to critique the increasingly, what we might call the increasingly imminent frame, is something that this book also picks up on. That was one of the things we wanted to do, because often the story of Christianity and Platonism is something that's told in relation to the early and the medieval church. But here we've told the story as much as we can up to the modern period. And I'm hoping that also is one of the kind of contributions of this book.
Yeah, and it does seem to be that there is a renewed interest, particularly, I guess, in the metaphysics of participation. I know, like, the one that I'm aware of is Hans Boersma. I'm not, like, an expert in this area by any means, so I know you guys know others. But it does seem curious that there is an increased renewal, or I guess renewed interest in it. Why might that be, in your opinion, that there is, like, kind of a return to certain aspects of Platonism to some degree?
Yeah, I think that increasingly the kind of dangers of living in a kind of flat ontology, a kind of realm of pure immanence, are manifest to us. They're manifest to us, you know, we've known for ages about anthropogenic destruction to the environment, but now it's sort of coming back to get us in a way that is existentially threatening, whether it's, you know, kind of wildfires or drought or pandemic. I mean, all of these have a kind of they're ecological catastrophes, and you know, our the way we relate to the environment is a direct result of our metaphysics. One of the things I think that the reason we're interested in recovering participation is, we're interested in recovering a kind of way of understanding the world around us, which is not purely based on anthropocentric constructions of reality. One of the things that Christian Platonism does that's quite interesting, and we reference this a little bit with the divine ideas, is that it creates a kind of sovereignty of ideas. It protects the sovereignty of things like the beautiful and the good and the just and the true, and takes them out of human subjectivity and places them inherently in nature itself. one of the things I often say to students in my religion and nature classes, how do we stop constructing the world simply according to our own needs and wants? What would have to happen to see nature as something that has a kind of intrinsic value unto itself that we need to respond to, as opposed to simply shaping it to what we will in the pursuit of our own happiness? And part of that is recovering this notion of divine ideas of participation, that each individual thing is what it is by virtue of its participation in that divine idea. And we can look at the practicality of that with a very simple example. We might look at a pine forest, for example, and think, well, you know, there's countless numbers of pine trees here, and so it doesn't matter if we go and cut down, you know, 50 or 60% of them. There's another forest on the other side of the mountain. But if we think about it from the perspective of participation, each one of those individual trees or animals or people are participating in the divine idea, and they're unfolding that divine idea. It has its each individual object, therefore, has its own uniqueness, and it has its own intrinsic value. And we need to respond to that in a far more dialogical manner, even than simply one that's an imposition of human wants. And so, you know, just to go back to that environmental issue, I mean, we've known for the best part of 200 years at least that we're making a mess of the planet. We have the technological and the scientific means to stop what's going on. The issue isn't science and technology. The issue is the cultural framework in which those are deployed. And it's the, I think part of it is the problem of this purely immanent ontology. To recognize the intrinsic value in things requires a kind of fundamental questioning of the immanent frame. And I think that's what we see in this renewed interest in participation. You know, you talked about Boersma's book, and also Andrew Davison's book, Participation in God. There's been a few others, and I think all of these are interested in recovering this much, much deeper and richer view of the world around us. And what's exciting about this is it's taking it beyond ressourcement and Lubach, and it's taking it beyond radical orthodoxy and the way that's sort of been done in the Anglican tradition, and it's broadening it out to a much bigger constituency. And I think that's what's so exciting about this, because it offers a robust critique to the logic of immanence that has a you know, 2,000-3,000 year history behind it, and a tremendous amount of resources that we can call upon. What are real significant existential issues now?
Dr. Kinney, do you have anything you wanted to add to that?
Sure, I might pick up on those excellent points from Alex from a slightly different perspective. As I articulated it earlier, in antiquity, Platonism was really the very powerful way of understanding reality, transcendentalist understanding of reality, that conjoined with a particular approach to one's actual life, offered the opportunity, it claimed, to come into immediate contact with a deeper divine level of reality. And as I said earlier, the Christians picked up on that in their own way. Therefore, ancient Platonism as it began, was an exceptionally forceful anti-materialist philosophy. It was a philosophy that pushed back against relativism, materialism, and those are exactly the issues, I think, that are bringing it to the fore again in the contemporary world, right? So there's a kind of arid objectivism that goes with scientific naturalism or materialism today, and with it that specious idea that, you know, Charles Taylor talks about of the view from nowhere, right? The objectivist view from nowhere. The Platonist tradition totally rejects that and says perhaps that has a place at an intermediate level of knowledge, sciencia, to use Augustine's term, dianoia, as the Greeks use it, and that's fine. But the whole point of Platonism is to go deeper into a level, to the intelligible level through nous, or what Augustine calls sapientia, contemplatio, right, to something deeper. And the tradition, pagan and Christian, claims that by the fundamental changing of the self, whatever the means are, sacramental, scriptural, however you understand it, there's a way to do that so that you can then understand that very sacramental understanding of reality and of the earth that Alex just articulated, right? So it's the pushback, I think, behind that in our culture against all of this sort of empty scientific ways of thinking about the world. And then with it comes an understanding within certainly the Christian Platonic tradition that the source of evil is that egotistical libido dominandi, to use the Augustinian phrase, that desire to dominate, which collectively in society generates the problems that Alex was articulating. So in some sense, Platonism, because of the very force of it as the founding tradition of a transcendental understanding of reality, I think is of interest again for precisely the reasons that drew early Christians to it in the first place. And I would add, by the way, this is something also that occurred in the Renaissance, right? The Renaissance was pushing back against so much of what had happened in the rise of nominalism and all of the issues that came with that. And Platonism was the tradition that articulated a whole glorious artistic understanding of reality, rooted again in a higher frame of existence, the divine.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've covered quite a bit of ground here, from, you know, defining Platonism to the historical development, and now into, you know, some implications for retrieving Christian Platonism today on things like ethics and environmental ethics and how we understand beauty. So I think we've covered a lot of ground, but I do want to give both of you gentlemen a chance to, if you'd like to give us any recommended resources outside of your book. Obviously, we want to recommend the book that both of you have edited, Christian Platonism, A History, and that's from Cambridge University Press, but also any other helpful resources that you think our listeners might be interested in if they want to dig a little deeper on this. And then if you have any upcoming work on this topic that you'd like to share with us, we'd love to hear it.
I would just say, I think in terms of participation, we've just had this excellent book by my friend Andrew Davison at Cambridge, Participation in God, which I think is quite an excellent resource for getting into this tradition. I think Craig Carter's work on the great tradition for the broader audience, I think is excellent. I also think of course there's no substitute for going ad fontes though with some of this material as well. And then I would just say I'm hoping to have finished quite soon, which is gives away why I'm focused on nature. A book I'm working on completing called Participation in Nature, which takes up a range of Christian thinkers from early to contemporary, thinking about how metaphysics allows us to relate to the world around us and perhaps developing a kind of metaphysical ecology, which I think is something that will speak to a broad audience and bring a much needed faith perspective to a lot of the contemporary debates about the environment And I'm hoping that that will help that conversation, which is already ongoing.
I thank you for that question, Brandon. I would strongly recommend for any of our listeners here today, if you're interested in the development of early Christian philosophy, there's a marvelous new set of essays, history that Mark Edwards from Oxford has done with Routledge. I think it's called The Handbook of Early Christian Philosophy. I did the Augustine chapter, but I can't remember the exact title here at the moment. But it's just terrific, because for so long, Christian philosophy was the philosophy that couldn't speak its name. You know, I mean, people say, "Oh, it's Christian philosophy. You can't use that term. It's, you know, it's outrageous." Blah blah blah. Right, and so it's wonderful that someone has actually gone back to the ancient period and pulled together all of the wonderful Christian philosophy that was done at the earliest stages. And so I think it's would be very, very helpful, particularly for traditions that work very closely with the New Testament, to be able to access the early Christian forms of philosophical reflection and see how integral to early Christian thought philosophy was, and how quickly philosophy became, as it were, Christianized. As a result. And that's the fascinating story in so many ways. So now my self-advertisement, I do have a recent, I've written a bunch of books on Augustine, right? Besides my book on paganism. And I have one that's come out. It's meant to be a crossover book, that's accessible to not just scholars, but to, learned people who are interested in these things. From Bloomsbury has a new series called Reading Augustine. I don't know whether you've come across this. And so I have a book in there called On God, the Soul, Evil, and the Rise of Christianity, which articulates some of the things that I've been saying here in a short format. I think it's 175 pages, and intended, for general audiences. So that might interest, again, people who are intrigued by some of the issues that we've been considering today with respect to ancient Christianity.
Awesome. Well, this has been really great. I really appreciate you both taking the time to talk with us about this. This is fun. There's some great resources as well to check out. So for everybody who's been listening, I encourage you to check out the resources that have been mentioned, as well as make sure to either, if you can't get a copy of the book itself, I know a lot of our listeners have their students, and their libraries have gigantic book budgets to get books. Go tell your library to buy this book and to get it in your library so that others can have a chance to have it as a resource as well. So I commend it to you. I think it's really, really fascinating history. And a lot of people are, I think, at least in my segment of the universe, are interested more and more in these types of things. So this has been a lot of fun. So thank you both. Thank you a lot for this. This has been great. I really appreciate your thoughts, and everybody's been listening. Again, check it out, and thanks for tuning in to the only analytic, Baptist, and confessional podcast on the planet, and we'll talk to you soon.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.